Hi, Richard here. We're back for 2026. It's been a long, hot summer, and we're coming back this week with some stories of new beginnings. Sarah, it's time to put down the Sharon, to kick the Rellos out of the rumpus room, put some calamine lotion on your mozzie bites, and direct your mind, your heart and soul to the business of conversations.
Our first story for the year comes from you, Richard. It's an extraordinary conversation about beginning again with Felisa Jamirza, who had to reinvent herself after a terrible encounter with the Queensland Police.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Felisa Jamirza is a former beauty queen. She's a three-time Miss Australia winner. And for a while, it was a pretty deluxe, glamorous life for someone who grew up in a rough neighbourhood in Western Sydney. Nowadays, Felisa is a counsellor. She's worked with victims of domestic violence, and that's something she's experienced herself, having been involved in a relationship with an abusive bikie gang member. Felisa is also interested in helping people from hard backgrounds who've suffered trauma, and that's something she knows about too. In 2016, Felisa was living on a property in country Queensland with her new partner, Dean, who wasn't abusive, but he was a major meth dealer at the time. One morning, they were woken up by 8 flashbang grenades that were thrown into their bedroom by Queensland Police on a dawn drug raid. 3 of those grenades exploded on and around Felisa's body, leaving her with major burns and injuries. While her partner Dean was sentenced to 10 years in prison, Felisa pled guilty to lesser charges of drug supply and was given a 3-year suspended sentence. And she used those years to study and become a qualified counsellor. Now she's really interested in the question for people who've grown up, like she did, in a world of crime. Who gets a second chance in this society? Felisa's absolutely hair-raising life story is told in her memoir, co-written with journalist Erin O'Dwyer. It's called Accessory. Hi, Felisa.
Hi.
You grew up in Toongabby in Blacktown in Western Sydney.
Yeah.
What's the house like that you remember as a little girl? Describe the house to me.
You know how kids muck around and joke around with each other and instead of Toongabby, we'd call it Toonscabby? So we did kind of know the area that we were living in wasn't the same as where other kids were living, so we'd taunt each other, where are you from? Oh, Toonscabby, you know.
Did you ever feel like vandalising the street signs, like saying, yeah, welcome to Toonscabby?
Welcome to Toonscabby. So the house was a 2-storey home. We had quite a large backyard in the front. My father had put pavers down so I could ride my bike. We'd done a lot of improvements to make that housing commission house a home, put up wallpaper because they were gyprockers, gyprocked up a wall to make the house just a bit more homely.
What kind of menagerie of animals did you have in that place?
We had a ferret, we had ducks, we had guinea pigs, we had a 3-legged Roman nose bull terrier, we had a cat, we had a lot of chickens. So we had an array of animals.
Was there a strong sense of community in that street?
Yeah. We all knew each other. We all knew our neighbours. All the kids played together. So I'd say that there was a really big sense of community back then.
You say, though, the house and the street had a dark history to it. What was that dark history?
So the house that we lived in Debbie Way, the Murphy brothers moved out of there and then we moved in.
The Murphy brothers who were convicted of the murder of Anita Cobby back in the 1980s?
Correct.
You wouldn't have known that as a little girl growing up, though, would you?
I didn't know that, but I was told that as I had gotten a little bit older. Me and my cousins always felt that the house had some kind of energy to it, some kind of heavy energy. And when we used to walk up the stairs, we used to walk up really, really fast because we always felt like somebody was walking behind us. We'd always want to turn the lights on before we'd walk up the stairs. And they were creaky old wooden stairs, so they did make noises, but we felt that way even without having known the history yet. Taps used to turn on by themselves, electrical items used to turn on by themselves, light switches used to go on and off by themselves, used to flicker. It was also built on a old rubbish dump. So who knows what people were dumping in that rubbish dump before they built those houses on there. So always felt there was some kind of a strange energy, heavy energy there.
Your parents, the way you describe your parents, they seem like both extraordinary people. Your dad, Yuri, and your mother, Brenda. First of all, Yuri, he's Russian, but he was a really specific kind of Russian, Circassian. These are like people who'd come into the Black Sea area of what was the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
How did he end up in Australia?
Yuri had a really adventurous life. His father was from Adyugea, which is Circassian. So they're in the mountainous regions near Sochi for people that are not familiar with that area. Very beautiful part of the world.
How was he with you? What kind of tidbits of Russian folk wisdom did he like to unload onto you, Felicia?
Oh, wow. So much. Very security conscious, very safety conscious. And I think that's because of the way that he grew up. I wasn't allowed to go on school camps. He would say things to me like, if you ever get kidnapped, make sure that you get your fingers and rub them on your forehead, and with the oil from your forehead, make out something on the glass of the car, the window of the car, or put your DNA everywhere that you possibly can so that you can be found. And as a child, well, as a young girl, I used to think, that's quite extreme, Yuri. But a lot of the lessons that he did teach me, those extreme survival lessons, I actually used some of them later in my life. So it wasn't all in vain for Yuri giving me those tips, those safety tips.
You're right that he and his brother were working as gyprockers. They worked at the Westfield Tower in Sydney and all that. But he had a few criminal sidelines on the side at the time. What kind of criminal activities was he engaged in?
He kept us out of that. We weren't privy to too much of it. But Yuri was involved in arms, and he was always quite mysterious about it. He'd go overseas and then he'd come back with a whole bunch of money, expensive presents, shoes, clothes, items, caviar. He used to bring caviar home in his suitcase.
To Toon Gabby.
Yes.
Suitcases of caviar and all that. So was criminal activity kind of normalised? Were you kind of conscious of criminal activity going on all around you when you were a kid?
It didn't faze me, and I think it became normalised.
How did he then find his way into the security business?
He was in business with his brothers, and he used to do a lot of private investigating as well. And Brenda's told me that they used to go around together and do stakeouts.
This is your mum, Brenda?
Yeah, Brenda and Yuri used to do stakeouts, PI work, like follow people and all sorts of things.
Your mother would go on these stakeouts?
Brenda
as well?
Would go. Right. We used to go on the stakeouts. And Yuri also used to do some stuff in King's Cross. He would drive the sex workers to and from jobs because they'd often in those days be carrying a lot of cash. And Yuri had a gun. So that was something that was an asset in regards to they felt protected, or the brothels where they worked felt protected if Yuri was transporting them to and from.
With that and the cargo airline you mentioned and a whole lot of other things, arms dealing, suddenly there was a ton of money coming into the house.
Yeah.
What kind of conspicuous consumption was Yuri practicing while you're still in this housing commission house in Toon Gabby?
We were either feast or famine, and it was like that throughout my whole childhood. It was very up and down. We'd have more money than what we could spend, and then we wouldn't have enough money to buy groceries, or we'll only have to buy little groceries. So it was really feast or famine. I think the most prominent thing that was purchased within the family, and we all shared it, was a Rolls Royce. So we were driving around in a Rolls Royce, and it was parked out the front in Debbie Way.
Would anyone touch it, or are they no better than to touch your dad's Rolls Royce?
No, no one would touch it because we were all friends there and the family was very well liked. We were always very generous, and the extended family too was very well liked. So we were the type of family that if we had extra, we would share it. If somebody needed some money and we only had $10, we'd give them $5 and say, you know, fix me up later. So we always had that kind of philosophy about life, and all our neighbours appreciated that.
And then he started losing money, and then you write that the drink overtook him.
Yeah.
He started to hit the drink really, really hard. What was it like to see that happen to him?
I always had a fear that that is how Yuri's life would end, because I had seen other members of my family pass away from cirrhosis of the liver and cancers related to excessive consumption of alcohol. I remember looking at one of my uncles when he was in hospital, and he had late stages of liver disease and liver cancer, and he was completely jaundiced, and he was so thin, so skinny, and his stomach was so inflated, and they had to put tubes in it to relieve the pressure of all the fluid that had built up in the abdomen because the liver wasn't working correctly, or the whole system wasn't working correctly. And I remember looking at him and thinking, this is my worst nightmare. And then I thought, I really hope my father doesn't end up dying in this way. A part of me hoped that Yuri seeing his brother so unwell would be a deterrent, but it wasn't.
You found him on a bench at a train station one day. What state was he in?
He had a really long beard. He was very dishevelled. He had cuts and bruises all over his legs and feet. He had bruises actually all over his body. And that was really, really devastating. It'd be devastating for anyone to find their parent like that. But you would look at Yuri, and when he's sober, such an intelligent, charismatic person, so kind, so generous, such a good sense of humour. And then when he was drinking, you had that split. It was a completely different personality, someone that couldn't even be reasoned with.
So apart from being devastated, were you also angry with him?
The anger came later. I was more concerned about his health. I wanted him in rehab. I wanted him to get better. And I knew that addiction was a disease and something that needs to be treated.
Did you try and stop him from drinking? Did you, I don't know, try confiscating bottles and do things like that?
So many times we tried to stop him from drinking. I used to take his photograph into all the local bottle shops and say, don't sell to this man, he's an alcoholic. I'm pretty sure they would have ignored me. But also, I remember he was drinking and he wanted to use the car. He continuously wanted to use the car to drive to get more alcohol. So Brenda and I and my sister, we ended up slashing the tyres on all the cars so that he couldn't drive. Then when he found out the tyres were slashed on the cars and he couldn't drive to get the alcohol, he opened up the bin and he started getting out the dead Marines, we call them dead Marines, but the empty bottles with just a tiny little bit of alcohol in the bottom. And he was trying to suck those last little drops out of these dead Marines out of the garbage bin at the front of our house.
Meanwhile, you say you were an ugly duckling as a little girl, and then you grew up and you weren't an ugly duckling anymore.
I never saw myself as particularly attractive, but I noticed as I was getting older or growing up that other people were giving me that feedback. Old men in the supermarket would look at me and Brenda would say some choice things, you know, keep your eyes off my daughter, you dirty old man. I go, oh, my God, Mum, stop, you know. Anyway, so all of that started to happen. And then I realised as I got a little bit older, I could leverage off that and make my life, what I thought was going to be slightly easier. Boy, was I wrong.
So you became this beauty pageant winner. What kind of places did that life take you to?
I never thought in a million years that I was going to win. I entered because the incentive was to get a free trip overseas, and I'm always wanting to go somewhere and do something. And, you know, I thought, what a good way for me to be able to go overseas with no cost, you know. I ended up in the final, and then it was between me and another lady or girl at the time. And the final question was, can you describe yourself in one word? And I just on the spot grabbed the microphone and I said, amazing. And then I strutted down the strutted down the stage. And Yuri was alive then and he was horrified. And
why was he horrified?
He was horrified because later he told me he thought, there's no way I would win if I was being so presumptuous to tell everyone that I was amazing, you know, and I was smucking around, I was having a good time. I thought it was fun. And the other lady answered the question, but she didn't answer it in one word. She answered it in like 75 paragraphs. And because of that, because I took the instruction to answer the question properly, that's what got me over the line to win.
So that led you into going out all the time. And, of course, you started to become interested to all kinds of men who probably fancied you and could see you as some kind of trophy girlfriend at the time. I suppose you could have seen that, though, couldn't you, that those kind of men wanted you for that purpose?
I think when I was younger, I didn't have the self-awareness or the perception or the worldview that I have now. I've done a lot of things and I've seen a lot of things and I've been in a lot of different situations. So now the way that I look at the world is completely different. The way I look at relationships is completely different. Back then, I thought I was just having a good time. I thought it was all shits and giggles, you know. I didn't think too much of it. I didn't take it seriously.
Did you think you could handle it, given you'd grown up in a rough suburb, you'd had a dad in serious straits? You might have been confident too that you could handle difficult people in difficult situations.
Yeah, and I think it made me accept a lot of things I otherwise would not have accepted if I had grown up in a different environment. But in saying that, that's not an excuse. We all have free will. We all have choices. But it is a reason. And it's always really good to look at the reasons behind why we do certain things, why we behave in certain ways, because then we're able to reflect on that and not repeat that into the future and learn from that. Instead of beating yourself up about it, you can learn from it.
So you started going to clubs in King's Cross in Sydney and having a lot of fun and dancing and having that wild old time that you do when you're a young person. And being a beauty pageant queen, you were a figure of interest to some of the members of the Nomad bikie gangs that were hanging around the Cross. What did you make of that world as a teenage girl looking on to outlaw motorcycle gang like the Nomads operating in King's Cross?
I absolutely loved those days. They were so fun. It felt like there were no rules. You could just go out and have a knockabout good time. And, yeah, it was a different time. And I always got along well with people that were not your typical straighty 180 person, somebody with a bit of a cheeky sense of humour, bit of charisma, bit out there, bit different to everyone else.
So you hooked up with a bikie named Cam. What status did Cam have in the organisation, the Nomads, when you started dating him?
He was a nom, which means you're a nominee, so you do all the shit jobs, like cleaning the clubhouse and holding the girlfriend's handbags in the nightclub, initiation type stuff to prove that you're going to make a good member. And then you get your patch and you become a fully fledged member. But he moved up quite quickly. And I think that's because physically he was very strong, but he also had a really good sense of humor, very kind. And those were all the reasons why I was attracted to him. And back then, I didn't think anything of him being a nominee. We used to go to the clubhouse and there'd be parties at the clubhouse and it was just fun. And I was young and I didn't actually understand how serious things would get and how quickly they would get serious.
Looking back, what kind of person do you think joins an outlaw motorcycle gang?
The type of child or young boy that grows up in either a broken home or parents that are neglectful or not present, or there's some issue there where they are really seriously lacking a sense of family. And if something or someone comes along and they make you feel like you belong, you suddenly feel important. And when you feel important, you'll sell your soul for that. And that's how they get into these situations. Because if you look at the majority of the young men that are in gangs, they're always from the lower socioeconomical bracket. We don't get your super wealthy families coming up and saying, oh, you know, my son's joined a bikie gang. It doesn't happen.
Yes, Nigel went out of grammar school to join a bikie gang. No, you don't hear that so often. No.
Nigel the Nomad.
Yes.
No, you don't see that happening. So it's also a poverty issue. It's also a social issue. So these lost boys don't just end up these violent criminals for no reason. There's always a reason behind why they end up in those situations.
You mentioned Cam moved quite quickly up the ranks and he was physically big. So he graduated from, you know, holding girls' handbags at the nightclub and cleaning the clubhouse floor to doing what? What kind of activities was he becoming involved in once he became a proper, fully fledged member?
A lot of standover stuff, extortion, you know, collecting debts from people. And so he had that brute force about him that was appealing. And he made easy money from that because he looked intimidating. He didn't even really have to do anything. Just the look of him would intimidate people enough for them to think, okay, I better pay my debts.
Where did he move to from there?
He started cooking.
Cooking what?
Meth.
And in that process, What was he like when he came home at the end of the day after he'd finished cooking meth?
It completely destroyed him. Completely destroyed him as a person, as a human being. I remember feeling a very big sense of loss during that time, because in front of me I was looking at a person that essentially didn't exist anymore within that moment.
Did he become that way by, I don't know, just inhaling free floating powder around the meth lab, or was he actually using as well?
He wasn't wearing a mask, and I spoke to him about it. But looking back retrospectively, probably also using to stay up for the amount of hours needed to finish the cook. So probably a bit of both. And then that was just a really disastrous mix.
What was he like when he came home then?
Skin grey, bags under his eyes, and a vacant, like a very vacant stare, like the lights are on but no one's home. No soul left. He became paranoid. He used to always think that there was a drone following us. And I remember I came home one day and he had unpicked all of the stitching out of my leather couch because he thought there was a bug inside the couch. So I came home, this beautiful Italian leather lounge had been completely unpicked and all the stuffing was everywhere. And then one night he thought we had a bug in our wall. And when I went to bed, the hole in the wall that he had kind of dug to try and get this hypothetical bug out, it was probably the size of a 50-cent coin when I went to sleep. When I got up the next morning, you could fit a whole body inside the hole that he had made in that wall.
Were you frightened of him at this point?
I wasn't frightened at that point, but I think that's because my sense of dangerous situations was probably a little bit desensitized. Things that other people would think are dangerous, I wouldn't perceive as dangerous because of my upbringing and because of the environments and because of the things that I had experienced. But with Cam, his drug use increased, and I only realized the full velocity of that when I saw that some money was missing. Quite a lot of money was missing, and he admitted that he had taken that money and bought drugs with that money. And that's when I thought, okay, we've got a serious problem here. So with the more status and power he got within the club and the more violent that he would be outside of the home, he started to bring that into the home. And we had an argument one day and I said, don't bring your club shit into my house. It doesn't work like that here. So he was kind of changing within the club, but then bringing those changes into the home, those violent behaviours.
Why do you think you picked a guy like that in the first place?
When I first met him, he was weighing his broccoli. Talk about transferable skills.
I thought it was going to be some kind of strange slang metaphor or something like that. You mean literally weighing broccoli?
Yeah, very right. Health conscious.
Right.
Used to work out a lot, had an amazing body. And so the last thing on my mind was him becoming an addict. So it was all a bit shocking to me. So, yes.
How violent did he get with you?
The two, I guess, most poignant incidents that happened would have been when he was chasing me around the house with a sawn-off shotgun and it was cocked, and I remember being really annoyed about it being cocked. I should have been annoyed about the whole thing, right? But I was especially annoyed about it being cocked because those bullets are heavy-duty bullets. So I was pretty pissed off about that, and I thought, you're high and you're running around with a cocked shotgun. Like, that's just absolute stupidity. So the argument was over the fact that he thought I hadn't called him a taxi, and that's how it started. Then I ran outside and I was hiding in front of the neighbor's fence, and he walked out of the house with a towel wrapped around it. And he said, I can see you. Get up and come back into the house or I'm going to kill your father. I'm going to shoot Yuri. So Yuri's in the back room. He's frail and not well. And so I stood up and I walked back into the house. And then lo and behold, who turns up? The taxi I called. So he wrapped the shotgun back up in that towel and he got in the taxi and he left. So, yeah. Yuri and I had seriously planned to knock him, to kill him, because we just didn't see a way out of this situation. And Yuri said, what will happen is I'll take the blame and I'm dying, so it won't matter anyway. And we had agreed to do that. I knew that there was a high chance that he was going to kill me. We had had an altercation where he had strangled me and I'd lost consciousness, ended up in the hospital, because those two things correlate. Once you've been strangled, there's a very high chance that it will end in a fatality next time. And he used to drive me in and around remote areas in the Blue Mountains and say, if I killed you and I dumped your body here, no one would find you. So they're the reasons why Yuri and I were like, he's got to go. It's either me or him. It's got to be him. But it didn't come to that.
Why not?
Because I ended up going to central New South Wales and essentially hiding for a period of time.
What happened to him in the end? Did he go to jail?
He did. He ended up being found in some well-known murderer's house that had just gotten out of jail for murder. So he ended up drowning in his own shit eventually anyway. I didn't have to do anything in respect to that.
It was around about this time you met your fiancé, Dean. How did you meet Dean?
What had happened was somebody had told me that Cam was cheating on me with an escort from Melbourne, and he had tagged her, or she had tagged him, and they were shopping in Melbourne, and I couldn't look on the Facebook page. So I asked Dean if I could go on his Facebook and have a look, and he said, yeah, sure. So I went on, and yes, he was cheating. And then I started speaking to Dean only as a friend, in that capacity as a friend at that time. The relationship was one of protection more so than anything else, because I knew that if I was with Dean, I'd be left alone by Cam. I knew that I would be safe if I was with Dean.
How was he making his living at the time?
I knew that he had a past, and I knew he had a reputation. He had a tow truck business, a towing company. He told me that he had just sold his company, and that's where the surplus of money was coming from. And I was naive to think that what he told me in the initial stages was the truth.
He told you he was in the tow truck business, and he was. Yes. But how was he really making his serious money at the time?
Yeah, illegally, through drugs and other means.
What other means?
There were some charges in relation to firearms as well.
So how much money was coming through his door then at that time?
Oh, a lot. We had a money counter. I remember that. The old school one that goes, you put it through and it makes that sound. Quite a lot of money, more money than what we could ever spend, to be honest.
How lavishly were you living?
To me, because I had experienced that feast or famine lifestyle growing up. Sometimes I'd have really nice things, sometimes I wouldn't. Sometimes we'd have a lot of money, sometimes we wouldn't.
That was normal as well?
Yeah, I didn't really think much of it, to be honest. I thought, yeah, okay, I like nice things, but people that know me know I'm not materialistic. I value other stuff over materialistic things. But of course, it was nice. And I thought, somebody that's grown up the way that I grew up, if they had an opportunity to make money really, really quickly, if that was actually put in front of them or proposed to them, or you could have all of this, look, a lot of people probably could say, no, I wouldn't do that. But you cannot fully say that unless you're in that position or you're in that predicament. And it wasn't really even about that. It was more about that I needed to protect myself, and I felt very safe with Dean.
So he had a property in country Queensland near Hervey Bay. Mm-hmm. And that's where you went to live, the two of you. What was the property like?
Farm life ain't for me.
Really?
Yeah, lots of snakes. And look, it was beautiful. It was picturesque and it was peaceful. Up until the raid, it was peaceful. And it was just a little bit too boring for me. I had eaten in every restaurant in the main street within a week. I was from Sydney. I said, you know, I'll give it a go, but I don't think this is for me. So we had already decided to move because there wasn't enough action there for me, but boy, did the action come.
Yeah. that brings us to this day, February the 9th, 2016, Queensland police, it turns out, had been surveilling your house and the both of you for months. Take me through what you remember of that day, the morning of the raid.
So initially, I didn't really know what was going on. I was asleep and then I felt this really intense burning and pain. And I really thought it was a home invasion. I thought I'd been shot in the face and I was still alive. So I was just laying there and I thought, I've been shot in the face. I need to just pretend I'm dead for a bit to figure out what to do if I even continue to live past the next few minutes. So I'm laying there and then more grenades start coming in and then I hear from a loudspeaker that it's the police. And then I go, okay. So once I heard it was the police, I started crawling to try and get into the walk-in robe because the grenades were still coming in the window and I was trying to shelter myself. But at that point in time, I didn't know it was grenades. I just did not know what was going on. I just knew it was the cops and I was trying to get myself to safety.
These are flashbang grenades. What happens when a flashbang grenade goes off?
There's a very loud sound, a lot of smoke. And they're very hot, very, very hot. They're not designed to come into contact with human skin. They're not designed to come into contact with furniture, bedding, etc. They're meant to be rolled in to disorientate the person that they're trying to arrest or whatever else.
And how were these flashbangs thrown into the room? Through a window or through the door?
They were thrown in through the bay window right at the front of our house. And I slept right next to the bay window. But they had a floor plan of our home, I'm assuming, because before you execute a raid, you would have a look at the plan, especially a raid of that size. So they could have anticipated that those flashbangs were going to come into contact with human skin and or furniture and bedding and become a fire risk because they had knowledge of the property prior and they could have reasonably perceived that aspect of it.
When they threw the flashbangs through the window, what part of your body did they land on?
My hand, my face, and then another one hit my elbow. And my elbow was exposed and just hanging out. There was blood everywhere. And I got to the space in between the end of the bed and the beginning of the walk-in robe. An officer had stepped through the bay window, cleared some of the glass here. Tactical officer stepped through the window. And he was shouting at me.
Can you even hear anything, though, at this point?
I can, yes. I'm disorientated, but I can hear what he's saying to me.
And you can't see anything, though,
can you? I can hardly see. I can see a little bit out of my left eye, but my right eye completely can't see a thing. That was actually frightening. Not being able to see was quite frightening. So he stepped through the bay window and he put an assault rifle to my head and he was pushing it into me and he was saying, put your hands up, I need to see your hands. And I thought, my elbow's blown out, my hand's literally nearly off. It was dislocated, so it was around the wrong way. All of my fingers were severed and hanging off and my thumb was detached from the main part of the hand. It looked like it'd been through a mincer and it started to turn purple, a purpley black colour and there was blood everywhere. And then there was burns on top, obviously. And I just was trying to drag my hands up with the elbow out and the hand all mangulated. I was trying to drag my hands up because he was screaming at me to show him my hands. It was all kind of a bit of overkill, I feel.
How about Dean? What was he doing while all this was going on?
Dean done an action body roll out of the bed and onto the other side of the floor and he didn't have a scratch on him. But me, I was looking like Freddy Krueger by the end of that raid.
So you're all arrested.
Mm-hmm.
How long was it before someone called an ambulance for you?
Quite a while. If they had intention to use these weapons, or if they feared for the safety of their officers to the extent that they claim, would they not have had an ambulance on standby?
When the ambulance did come, were you conscious?
I was. The ambulance officers were quite angry with the police because they were scared that I was going to go into shock and also that my hand had gotten to a point where it needed to be amputated. They were like, why didn't you call us earlier? This woman is going to go into shock. But they were trying to get me and Dean to open and unlock our phones as leverage for not calling the ambulance. And we didn't unlock our phones. I wasn't put under a cold shower. I wasn't given any burns first aid. I remember they had gotten a dirty tea towel from the kitchen and dipped it in water and scraped it across the right side of my face and my eyes where the burns were and tried to put some saline drops in my eyes after my eyes were just been burnt. So, yeah, that's the first aid treatment that I was given because I wouldn't unlock my phone.
Today I'm with counsellor, advocate for women in the criminal justice system and former Miss Australia, Felicia Jamirza. She's written a memoir called Accessory. So you were brought into hospital and there was a lot of concern about whether they could save your hand, whether it needed to be amputated, but they were able to hang on to it. Nonetheless, when you came out of surgery, the police appeared at your bed and charged you with drug trafficking.
Yes.
How much involvement had you had with Dean's criminal activities?
I knew what was going on, but I wasn't directly involved. The police knew that, and I think the method behind their madness might have been, if we harm somebody that's perceived by the public as a civilian, that's not great for us. But if we harm somebody that we're framing as a drug dealer, everyone's going to say, oh, well, collateral damage, tough luck.
Is the thinking that far evolved, or is it really just a case of police not being able to shift out of a kind of a narrative of the raid that they've got in their heads?
I think if they were going to charge me, they would have charged me at the house when they were reading out the warrant, because they were reading the warrant to me when I was sitting screaming on the front couch. They were reading it out.
But they didn't charge you at the time on the premises?
No, they only charged me in the hospital, in the resus room, after they realised my injuries.
What was rehabilitation like for you after that, to recover from your injuries, from the burns to the face, the damage to your eye, the hand that had to be stitched back on, the fingers that had to be stitched back together again and reconstructed, your elbow, all of that?
A lot of surgery, a lot of time in hospital, a lot of therapy. It was really, really difficult. And I was going through that recovery process whilst on bail and at the same time, Yuri's health was seriously deteriorating.
Your father was dying?
Yes, Yuri was dying. And every day that I was on bail, I used to wake up and think, please let me stay out long enough to bury my father. Then after that, whatever happens, happens. I'm willing to wear the consequences of whatever comes from, you know, my charges. I was already wearing the consequences in respect to my injuries in a very big way, but I really wanted to bury my father. So once I buried Yuri, I felt a weight was lifted on my shoulders that I didn't really have a responsibility or a promise to anyone on the outside if I was to go into prison.
In December 2017, you decided to plead guilty to the downgraded charges of drug supply. You just told me that you didn't have any involvement. I think you write in your book your only involvement really was weighing drug packages. Why did you plead guilty then?
I pled guilty because in Queensland, the law states that if you're involved in any part of the process, you may or may not be charged with the same charges as the principal. So as we know with law, everything's open to interpretation. So that's the way that the police and the prosecution chose to frame it. They also had charged me with production and supply, and they got dropped quite close to the court date. So I thought that because of all the media attention, there's no way that I would have gotten a fair hearing. And I thought it was the safest option to plead guilty to that charge. Retrospectively, looking back now, maybe I actually wouldn't have. I probably wouldn't have. But I didn't have the capacity to fight as much as what I wanted to because of the medical state that I was in. I still wasn't a well person at that time.
So you pled guilty and the judge gave you a 3-year suspended sentence. And he noted at the time, the sentencing judge noted that even though you'd had full knowledge of Dean's drug trade, your involvement was limited to testing and cleaning his scales. He described you as a high achiever who was, quote, in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong person, was impressed with your counselling, studies and the like. Nonetheless, you know, meth in communities like Hervey Bay in particular is this evil, abhorrent thing. It reduces communities to a state of utter desperation. It's in many ways worse than heroin addiction. Heroin addiction just leaves its user sort of pretty inert, but addiction to ice leaves people prone to violent outbursts, paranoia, violent crime, all those sorts of things. Did that ever enter your mind when you were living with Dean at that time and he was distributing drugs like that and what the effect it was having on the communities that he was within?
I didn't think very much of it at the time because I was young. And I'm not going to blame it on that, but I had other things on my mind, like my father was passing away and there was other things going on for me. And I wasn't hyper-focused on that aspect of it. And also, I was very focused on my safety. So I would turn a blind eye to anything, really, because I needed to protect myself by staying with Dean. So I didn't think about the implications and the impact that it has on the community. But with drugs and the drug problem, is it really a drug problem or is it a societal issue and an indicator that people have trauma and untreated mental illness and there's not enough support in the community? And a lot of the people that end up in prison as a result of taking drugs or selling drugs, you will find that they have untreated mental health disorders or they've got something going on for them that's a causation for that behaviour. A way of self-medicating, a way of numbing out. And everyone numbs out in different ways. You've got your workaholics, you've got people who are sex addicts, you've got people who take drugs to numb out. So I think it's more of a demand and supply situation and we need to look at what are the causations behind using? What's the root cause of using? And how do we support people in the community? How do we look at harm reduction? How do we make sure that these people receive the treatment that they need or that they're wanting to have? I'm the daughter of somebody who had an addiction that led to a lot of verbal abuse and a traumatic upbringing. And I'm also the ex-partner of somebody who was very addicted to methamphetamine. So that's why I highlight in this book that I was both the victim and the perpetrator. And those two things usually go hand in hand, which a lot of people don't realise.
Dean received a 10-year sentence and you were given that 3-year suspended sentence, like I said, and you spent those 3 years studying to become a counsellor. Why did you want to become a counsellor?
I didn't. I really didn't.
You didn't?
No, I really didn't want that. I wanted... The irony, are you ready for it? I wanted to be a lawyer, but I had to stop my law studies when I got charged because I wouldn't have been admitted to the bar. The law industry or the law sector now is changing a lot and they are actually accepting people into the law community to work as lawyers who have got lived experience. It's more valued now. But back then when I was charged, it felt like it would have been an impossible task. Another part of the reason was because I wanted to be at home with Yuri while he was dying and I wanted to be able to study from home. And back then, unlike now, it was very, very limited as to what courses you could study via correspondence. And social science counselling was one of the correspondence courses. So I thought, okay, I'll do that one. That looks interesting. And here I am.
How much did you enjoy it once you started doing it?
I absolutely love people. So it suited me down to a T and I think that I became much better at it after having lived experience of being injured, being arrested, going through DV, my father passing, so many things I had been through that gave me a real appreciation for the fragility of human life. When someone came to me and said to me that they'd been strangled, I know exactly what that feels like. Straight away, they don't feel judged. They don't feel judged. So my lived experience has taught me way more than what I learnt in a textbook. Academics always came very easy to me. I didn't try very much at school and I still got really good marks. I was kind of lucky in that way. And I just think my life experience has really, really aided me in being the therapist that I am today.
You made a damages claim against the Queensland Police for use of excessive force in that Dawn raid. You brought in an expert witness from the US who said that the use of grenades in that situation was unreasonable, excessive, inconsistent with professional police practice. And they settled with you out of court on this matter.
Correct.
What lingering effects has that Dawn raid had on you? Are you still carrying physical and traumatic injuries from that attack?
I have a close friend that's a plastic surgeon, which has come in handy. But apart from that, mentally and physically, I was not in a good way. And I never thought that I would get back to 100%. And I'm still not. I'm forever changed by what's happened.
A flashbang grenade exploded on your face.
Yeah. I still suffer with the implications of complex PTSD. I have very graphic, violent nightmares. They come and go. They come and go. But when I have them, they're quite disturbing. I can wake up in a complete cold sweat, have to change my pyjamas, have to have a shower, then change sheets, get back into bed. I've woken up with scratch marks all over my chest because in my sleep I've scratched my chest until it's been bleeding. All of those things have subsided, but they can come back and you can have a relapse. People that have PTSD know that when things become very stressful for them, they can have a relapse. So it's something that you will never be fully rid of in your life. It's about how you manage it and it's about how you live with it, essentially. When I first came out of hospital and I went home, I got permission to go back to Blacktown and I was still recovering. I was very paranoid. I would go out and when I would come back home, I wouldn't want to eat any of the food in the house because I thought that someone had been in the house and contaminated the food. And I used to write down the number plates of cars in the street. I think that was from being under surveillance and because the PTSD and the trauma was so fresh. But looking back on that now, I think, oh my goodness, you've come such a long way from feeling like you were a prisoner within your own mind, which is how I would explain it.
You broke up with Dean after he entered prison. He wanted you not to wait for him. He said that to you.
Liar. He so wanted me to wait.
I'm sure. But you broke up for a while. Why did you decide to make contact with him again while he was still in prison?
I saw something on television and it was something to do with the prison system. And I just felt so bad for Dean. I just felt so bad for him. And we had stopped speaking for a period of time because we had had an argument, but it was really over something that was, you know, petty.
And you make it clear he was never violent to you or cruel like that.
No, definitely not. He's a very kind-hearted person to the people that he loves. Yeah. Very good friend, but probably not a good enemy. So when he went to prison, we decided it would be the adult thing to do to try and be civil and remain friends and that we would still speak and I would support him as much as I could on the outside and I would have his back, all of those things. We thought that that was the right thing to do. But over time, I think too much tension and jealousy built up and it resulted in an argument and then we didn't speak for about a year and a half. So during that time is when I'd watched this television show, this documentary, and I thought I'm going to put in a form to apply to be able to visit the prison again.
You're now engaged again. He's out of prison. He's completed his sentence.
Yes.
And you're together again.
Yeah.
Is it hard living the normie life? Because you're living much more law-abiding, conventional life, both of you. Both of you now. I'm always mindful of that scene at the end of Goodfellas, which is a movie, I know, but, you know, Henry Hill goes into the Witness Protection Program with his family. He's living in some suburb somewhere and he's got to eat bad pasta and he's got to mow the lawn and he hates it. Is it hard living that normie life again without the money, the excitement, the adrenaline, that world that you've both walked away from?
When I got my first honest paycheck, I said to my mum, what am I meant to do with this? Should I use it to wipe my ass? And she was so angry. She was like, nothing is worth your freedom. And then went on this big rant. And I said, I'm sorry, I was just joking. I'm not going to say that again. I've got a really full life. I've got a lot of good friends. I've got family. I'm always studying something. I'm always working. I like to travel. My life is pretty full. And since the book coming out and going through this process, the things that I've been doing have been the opposite to a normie life. So it's kind of a little bit crazy, but in a good way now, as opposed to in an illegal way. So I've still got a pretty action-packed full life, but it's just not in the same way as it was before.
What an extraordinary story. Thank you for being so candid with me today, Felicia.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Felicia Jamirza's book is called Accessory. Today's conversation was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.